Goeienaand weer, baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. En ons verwelkom vir Jim Adams daar in Amerika. Goeienaand, Jim.
Goeienaand, Honey.
En dan toe ons ook vir Willie Koorts. Hy is natuurlijk in die Kaap. As ons sê Kaap, Willie, is het Sutherland of is in Kaapstad self?
Dis al drie eindelijk. Ek bly in Wellington, ek werk in Sutherland, ek was verlede week daar, ek is gestationeerd by ons hoofkantoor in Observatory in Kaapstad, ja, of so net so buiten die hoofstad.
Ja, wil jy beweeg oor die hele Kaapkolonie, soos hulle nie altijd.
En Noordkaap.
En dan professor Mati Hoffman, wat in die digitale planetarium woon.
Ja, ons het goeie nuus oor die digitale planetarium, hy word eersdag opgegradeer met 'n totaal nuwe rekenaar, kragtige rekenaarstelsel en nuwe laserprojektors, so ons ondersteuners sal nog moet uithou en geduldig wees tot so, kom ons sê nou maar om veilig te wees so in juni, en dan gaan ons weer voluit die mense bederf met programme daar.
Jim, let's turn our attention to the ISS. There was a crew change earlier in the week. What an interesting one, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's especially considering world affairs right now. We had an astronaut needed to return to Earth. He'd spent something like 355 days in space. And so he returned back to Earth on board the Russian Soyuz mission. So they flew about 5 hours. They detached from the ISS and they flew about 5 hours and landed safely in Kazakhstan. I mean, it's not uncommon to have U.S. astronauts fly on Russian vehicles. And it wasn't uncommon when we were flying the space shuttle to have Russian cosmonauts fly with us on the space shuttle to the International Space Station. The thing is that for me, especially watching the conflict in Europe and Eastern Europe and just the alignment of nations these days, that you still look at space exploration as an opportunity to understand one another, to collaborate together, to cooperate together, and ultimately to work on the goal of global peace for everyone. And so I think it was very symbolic that the Russians brought our astronaut home. And they did it professionally, and they all landed safely, and then they went their separate ways. So I think that was fantastic news today.
Mm. It's the International Space Station. That's why it's international.
Yes, it is international. The other thing that I wanted to mention about visiting the ISS. So the International Space Station is designed to hold 6 or 8 astronauts, and sometimes it grows to 10 or 12 because there's visitors, as one crew comes in to replace the existing crew, they only replace half at a time. So 3 will come in and then 3 will leave. So sometimes you get a few more people on board. So it can be a busy place, especially if you've got a crew change and then a cargo ship coming in like the SpaceX Dragon, and it's just going to get busier as SpaceX also starts to do crew changes for NASA, and ultimately Orbital ATK is going to be flying to the International Space Station as well, and we have JAXA bringing up cargo vehicles from Japan, so it's getting to be a very busy place. But one of the interesting things is that this month marks the 20th anniversary of Mark Shuttleworth's it was his only space flight, but it was the first space tourist visit to the International Space Station. He cut a deal with Russia to be able to fly on board a Soyuz up to the space station, spent about 8 days in space, and then came back home. Came back and ultimately returned to his life as an entrepreneur in South Africa. So 20 years ago today, he broke that barrier of people not necessarily having to be professional astronauts in order to fly in space.
Soon after that visit of Mark Shuttleworth to the space station, he undertook a tour of South Africa and visited many schools. He also founded, I'm not sure whether it was that same year or a bit earlier, the Shuttleworth Foundation, which still exists and made a big contribution through various funding schemes to education in South Africa. The Boyden Observatory of our university also benefited from that. And it's almost 20 years now. So next year, early next year, it will be 20 years after we got a grant of R500,000. It was a lot of money then to build the auditorium there at Boyden Observatory. And you once visited there and made a presentation there.
Yeah, we were speaking about Pluto, and I'm looking forward to returning again in early May.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. And in those days, we were still looking forward to the outcome of the New Horizons mission. It was not launched yet. It was a 10-year trip, if I remember correctly. So it was still in the final planning phases. But to come back to your story about the exchange of the crew, I notice here that the NASA Mark van der Hey spent 355 days on the space station, and that amounted to 5,680 Earth orbits. And a Russian colleague, he was for the same period in space, and that was his first space mission, or his first mission in space. And that's quite remarkable on your first mission in space to spend 355 days there, almost a full year.
And that first guy you just spoke about, he was actually the commander, I think. And there's a nice video on YouTube showing the official handing over of the ISS key. It's a real fancy key. It looks like a brass thing with all sorts of funny curls to it. I'm not sure if it fits anywhere. It almost looks like a key you find for a train. I know a train has got a funny key sometimes to operate it. But coming back to your to Jim's mentioning about the relations, there was basically no hard feelings. There's, these guys are up there. They're basically isolated, although they're in constant contact with the world, with the Earth. It was a really, really good handing over ceremony, and so the American has now taken over command again. So the working relationship up there is quite good. And Jim was saying, I count 10 people there. Of course, that was before Wednesday when three of them left.
Right. Yeah. Let's turn our attention to the red planet, Mars. The Ingenuity helicopter, that's Yapi's little toy. It seems it's doing very well, Jim.
Yeah, this is typical for NASA space missions, and we design them to last, like in the case of Ingenuity, I forget what it was. We would call it a success if it flew 3 times or so. And here it is 90 days later, and it's still flying, which is, just fantastic testament to the engineers that designed the thing. Obviously, it's not outfitted to do a mission of its own, but I have to imagine it's kind of tagging along with Perseverance, and will continue to tag along with the rover as long as it can.
Yeah, it's done 21 flights now, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, really amazing.
While it was mostly a technology demonstration during the first number of flights, it more and more started to undertake some surveillance tasks, and it will be important in particular during what I see they call it the second science campaign of the Perseverance. We need to want to move up into the delta area of the Jezero crater, and there are two dry river channels, and Ingenuity will go and explore to help decide which of the two dry river channels should be used by the Perseverance. And for that purpose, it have to fly around the little hill, and they have changed the software settings so that they can take, well, probably more risks. They have tested it, but it will be able to fly higher than the limit of 10 meters on which it was set before, and change speed while it is in flight, and all kinds of more flexible capabilities.
Yeah, and those capabilities, while they could be also, they can be helpful for Perseverance in terms of path planning, like you said, which course it should take, they are also critical capabilities to demonstrate as we move forward and we begin to think about the next rover that will have a flying buddy along with it so that they can do some reconnaissance before deciding which paths to take. You know, we lost Spirit, which was one of the smaller rovers, when we drove it onto what we thought was solid ground, but it turned out to be a sand pit, and we were just never able to get the rover out of it. So, of course, it had lasted many, many years past its design life, but still felt like that was sort of an avoidable thing if we had had the right reconnaissance.
The same applies to Voyager, isn't it? It's been there for years.
You can imagine, if you've got an operational mission that's working well, it's difficult to decide to turn them off, right? And although NASA does do it from time to time, like we ended the Cassini mission, we try really hard to get as much science as we can out of these missions, but we want to make sure that the science that they're going to do is relevant. So every few years, NASA holds what they call a senior review, and the senior review takes a look at what missions like Perseverance and Ingenuity and the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is flying, and MAVEN and Juno and all these missions can do in the next couple of years. And then this committee of senior scientists and engineers makes some recommendations to NASA about what the focus ought to be and whether or not the mission should continue. And so, as one might have expected, Perseverance and Ingenuity got renewed to continue their science mission and continue to explore the crater.
Jim, just for the sake of having more insight of the considerations when they make a decision to extend a certain mission, if we take, for example, the Perseverance rover together with the Ingenuity, how many staff members are more or less kept busy for most of their daily work by that mission? So is it a major commitment to funding, a lot of salaries, if you extend a mission?
Yeah, it is. That will probably keep close to 200 people employed. They're not all engineers sitting on console. There's a lot of scientists that are analyzing data and publishing papers, and there's also engineers thinking about future missions as well that are part of this mission.
Yeah, and when a mission ends, they are transferred to one of the other missions.
That's right. They don't lose their jobs. We try and do a lot of forward planning to make sure that they have a place to go when the mission ends. You know, obviously these are experienced people who would be in high demand by future missions as the future missions start to ramp up their operational phases.
I assume that there would be some scientists that will be part of several missions. I'm just thinking of our astronomers. They, you know, they have a certain interest, but they wouldn't just look at SOL data. They would get other data from other telescopes and even Hubble and so forth. So I assume there could be scientists that are basically dedicated to one project, but I assume some of them are multi-project, if you like, or multi-mission.
In fact, most of them are. That's right. Okay. But the employees that are on console, that are doing the path planning for the rover, yes, and that sort of thing, they're full-time on, yes, the Perseverance project. Yeah.
Yeah. Jim, I see that a new dish for the Deep Space Network was put into operation in February in Spain. What's the size of this dish?
It's 34 meters. It's huge, right? It's not NASA's largest. There was a decision made a couple of decades ago that would be the standard antenna that we would build from now on. And so, because NASA has these 370-meter antennas, which are enormous, you know, 34 meters is huge, 70 meters is enormous. And the nice thing is they standardized on the design. So they can buy one without having to do a lot of extra design work, and they can put them up pretty quickly, and they buy them from a variety of vendors. And then they use the local labor to set them up. So one might say, well, but a 70 meter might be more efficient at collecting signals, say, as you mentioned, Voyager, right? The further away a mission gets, the fainter its signal gets, so the bigger the antenna you'd want in order to be able to receive those signals. But in the process of standardizing on a 34 meter antenna, NASA has developed a technique to create an array of antennas, not as big as like the square kilometer array in the Northern Cape, but rather, you know, we can put three or four of these 34 meter antennas together and essentially get the same efficiency in receiving signals as we would from a single 70 meter antenna. So that's very exciting for Madrid, but it's also exciting for South Africa, because at the moment, SANSA, your space agency, is in negotiations with NASA to put a 34 meter antenna, maybe more, because NASA likes to have backups. They might put two, I'm not sure, in the Western Cape at Mikiesfontein near Sutherland.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm just looking at the specs for the one at Heartrail, which is actually originally part of the Deep Space Network. And that is 26 meters. So dish size is interesting, as you say. Obviously, your detectors become more and more sensitive these days, so you don't necessarily need such a big dish. And then I remember once being in a talk in the beginning of the SKA or what was Meerk or Kat then, Kat Karoo Array Telescope, which was seven dishes originally, and it got expanded to Meerkat 64 dishes. There's a sum you have to make on especially if you're going to mass produce them. As you say, if you try and make them too big, then they become very expensive and hard to keep up, etc. So I think they're in the 15 meter range. So yeah, it's always interesting, as you say, the dish size becomes more clumsy. It's got more wind resistance. It becomes heavy, etc. So yeah, it's an interesting sum that you make for the dish size.
Yeah, it is. And the 26 meter antenna has a lot of history too. So it was designed to communicate with the Apollo astronauts at the moon, right? So they're going to the moon. coming back. And so it didn't need to be as big as a 34-meter antenna, which is really optimized for communicating with Mars. So the 26-meter antenna has its history, you know, all the way back to the 60s. And today it has a life as a radio astronomy antenna.
Yes.
Working at Hartrau, yeah.
Yeah.
I noticed, Jim, I noticed that the addition of this one dish increased the capacity of the network, the deep space network, by 8%. And they state it means 8% more science. And they also state that one of the missions that will benefit from this increased capacity will be the Europa Clipper mission. Now, that's not a Europe Clipper mission, but a Europa Clipper mission, which means a mission to the moon Europa of Jupiter.
That's right. And that's very exciting. You know, Europa is this moon about the size of our moon, but we know that it's a frozen ice ball, and inside this several kilometer thick ice crust is an ocean of water that has 2 to 3 more times water in it than we have on Earth. Cool. And so as it goes in orbit around Jupiter, you know, orbits are always a little bit elliptical, so it pushes and it pulls just a little bit, and so it's stirring up this water. We know it's water because we can watch the orbit jiggle a little bit as it goes around. So there must be liquid in there. It's one of the places where we think if there were going to be life beyond Earth, we think that Europa would be the place to go to find it. The thing is, it's not accessible by human beings, because if you were to stand on the surface of Europa, you'd be exposed to Jupiter's radiation belts, and you'd receive a lethal dose of radiation in just 48 hours. So we can't send humans there, so we have to send a robotic mission. And Europa Clipper is the first of several missions that will go and do the reconnaissance at Europa, so that ultimately we can send a mission that will drill through the ice shell and down into that ocean water to try and look for the possibility of life.
Mars is also already far enough, and Jupiter is about more than twice that distance, 3 times that distance. So other than the problem with the radiation, to get a manned mission there would be an extremely big challenge this time of history. Of
right, Jim, if people want to contact you, it's via Facebook.
Yeah, the Facebook group. I love answering questions on the Facebook group.
Maarten, jou besonderhede?
Selfoonnommer 083-625-7154. 083-625-7154.
En dan, Willie?
Is 072-4579-208. 072-4579-208.
En dan die programse e-posadres is sterreplanete@gmail.com. sterreplanete@gmail.com. Tot volgende week. Bly lekker.